met, I came upon a man with four attendants. He tried to force me from the path. He struck me with his stick. Angered, I fell upon them, and I killed them. Could it be the leader was Laius? The one man left alive brought back a tale of robbers, Jocasta said. Laius was killed by robbers, not by his son, the poor innocent who died upon the mountain. As they talked, a further proof seemed given them that Apollo could speak falsely. A messenger came from Corinth to announce to Oedipus the death of Polybus. Oh, oracle of the god, Jocasta cried, where are you now? The man died, but not by his son's hand. The messenger smiled wisely. Did the fear of killing your father drive you from Corinth? He asked. Ah, king, you were in error. You never had reason to fear, for you were not the son of Polybus. He brought you up as though you were his, but he took you from my hands. Where did you get me? Oedipus asked. Who were my father and mother? I know nothing of them, the messenger said. A wandering shepherd gave you to me, a servant of Laius. Jocasta turned white. A look of horror was on her face. Why waste a thought upon what such a fellow says? She cried. Nothing he says can matter. She spoke hurriedly, yet fiercely. Oedipus could not understand her. My birth does not matter, he asked. For God's sake, go no further, she said. My misery is enough. She broke away and rushed into the palace. At that moment, an old man entered. He and the messenger eyed each other curiously. The very man, O king, the messenger cried, the shepherd who gave you to me. And you, Oedipus asked the other, do you know him as he knows you? The old man did not answer, but the messenger insisted. You must remember, you gave me once a little child you had found, and the king here is that child. Curse you, the other muttered. Hold your tongue. What? Oedipus said angrily. You would conspire with him to hide from me what I desire to know? There are ways, be sure, to make you speak. The old man wailed, Oh, do not hurt me. I did give him the child, but do not ask more, master, for the love of God. If I have to order you a second time to tell me where you got him, you are lost, Oedipus said. Ask your lady, the old man cried. She can tell you best. She gave him to you? Asked Oedipus. Oh, yes, the other groaned. I was to kill the child. There was a prophecy. A prophecy? Oedipus repeated. That he should kill his father. Yes, the old man whispered. A cry of agony came from the king. At last he understood. All true. Now shall my light be changed to darkness. I am accursed. He had murdered his father. He had married his father's wife, his own mother. There was no help for him, for her. For their children. All were accursed. Within the palace, Oedipus wildly sought for his wife, that was his mother. He found her in her chamber. She was dead. When the truth broke upon her, she had killed herself. Standing beside her, he too turned his hand against himself, but not to end his life. He changed his light to darkness. He put out his eyes. The black world of blindness was a refuge. Better to be there than to see with strange, shamed eyes the old world, that had been so bright. Antigone. I have taken this story from the Antigone and the Oedipus at Colonus, two of Sophocles' plays, with the exception of the death of Mnesias, which is told in a play of Euripides, The Suppliants. After Jocasta's death, and all the evils that came with it, Oedipus lived on in Thebes while his children were growing up. He had two sons, Polynices and Eteocles, and two daughters, Antigone and Ismene. They were very unfortunate young people, but they were far from being monsters all would shudder to look at, as the oracle had told Oedipus. The two lads were well liked by the Thebans, and the two girls were as good daughters as a man could have. Oedipus, of course, resigned the throne. Polynices, the elder son, did the same. The Thebans felt that this was wise, because of the terrible position of the family, and they accepted Creon, Jocasta's brother, as the regent. For many years they treated Oedipus with kindness, but at last they decided to expel him from the city. What induced them to do this is not known, but Creon urged it, and Oedipus's sons consented to it. The only friends Oedipus had were his daughters. Through all his misfortunes, they were faithful to him. When he was driven out of the city, Antigone went with him to guide him in his blindness and care for him, and Ismene stayed in Thebes to look out for his interests and keep him informed of whatever happened that touched him. After he had gone, his two sons asserted their right to the throne, and each tried to be made king. Eteocles succeeded, although he was the younger, and he expelled his brother from Thebes. Polynices took refuge in Argos and did all he could to arouse enmity against Thebes. His intention was to collect an army to march against the city. In the course of their desolate wanderings, Oedipus and Antigone came to Colonus, a lovely spot near Athens, where the one-time Erinyes, the Furies, now the benignant goddesses, had a place sacred to them, and therefore a refuge for suppliants. The blind old man and his daughter felt safe there, and there Oedipus died. Most unhappy in much of his life, he was happy at the end. The oracle, which once had spoken terrible words to him, comforted him when he was dying. Apollo promised that he, the disgraced, the homeless wanderer, would bring to the place where his grave should be a mysterious blessing from the gods. Theseus, the king of Athens, received him with all honor, and the old man died rejoicing that he was no longer hateful to men, but welcomed as a benefactor to the land that harbored him. Ismene, who had come to tell her father the good news of this oracle, was with her sister when he died, and afterward they were both sent safely home by Theseus. They arrived to find one brother marching against their city, resolved to capture it, and the other determined to defend it to the end. Polynices, the one who attacked it, had the better right to it, but the younger, Eteocles, was fighting for Thebes to save her from capture. It was impossible for the two sisters to take sides against either brother. Polynices had been joined by six chieftains, one of them the king of Argos, Adrastus, and another, Adrastus's brother-in-law, Amphiaraus. This last joined the enterprise most unwillingly because he was a prophet, and he knew that none of the seven would come back alive except Adrastus. However, he was under oath to let his wife Eriphyle decide whenever there was a dispute between him and her brother. He had sworn this once, when he and Adrastus had quarreled, and Eriphyle had reconciled them. Polynices won her over to his side by bribing her with the wonderful necklace that had been the wedding gift of his ancestress Harmonia, and she made her husband go to the war. There were seven champions to attack the seven gates of Thebes, and seven others within, as bold, to defend them. Eteocles defended the gate which Polynices attacked, and Antigone and Ismene, within the palace, waited to hear which had killed the other. But before any decisive combat had taken place, a youth in Thebes, not yet grown to manhood, had died for his country, and in his death had shown himself the noblest of all. This was Creon's younger son, Meneceus. Tiresias, the prophet who had brought so many distressful prophecies to the royal family, came to bring still another. He told Creon that Thebes would be saved only if Meneceus was killed. The father utterly refused to bring this about. He would be willing to die himself, he said, but not even for my own city will I slay my son. He bade the boy, who was present when Tiresias spoke, "Up, my child, and fly with all speed from the land before the city learns."
"Where, father?" asked the lad. "What city seek? What friend?"
"Far, far away," the father answered. "I will find means, I will find gold."
"Go get it, then," said Meneceus. But when Creon had hurried away, he spoke other words. "My father, he would rob our town of hope, make me a coward. Ah, well, he is old, and so to be forgiven, but I am young. If I betray Thebes, there is no forgiveness. How can he think I will not save the city, and for her sake go forth to meet my death? What would my life be if I fled away, when I can free my country?" He went to join the battle, and, all unskilled in warfare, he was killed at once. Neither the besiegers nor the besieged could gain any real advantage, and finally both sides agreed to let the matter be decided by a combat between the brothers. If Eteocles was the victor, the Argive army would withdraw. If Eteocles was conquered, Polynices should be king. Neither was victor. They killed each other. Eteocles, dying, looked upon his brother and wept. He had no strength to speak. Polynices could murmur a few words. "My brother, my enemy, but loved, always loved. Bury me in my homeland, to have so much, at least, of my city." The combat had decided nothing, and the battle was renewed. But Meneceus had not died in vain. In the end, the Thebans prevailed. And of the seven champions, all were killed, except Adrastus only. He fled with the broken army to Athens. In Thebes, Creon was in control, and he proclaimed that none of those who had fought against the city should be given burial. Eteocles should be honored with every rite that the noblest received at death, but Polynices should be left for beasts and birds to tear and devour. This was to carry vengeance beyond the ordinance of the gods, beyond the law of right. It was to punish the dead. The souls of the unburied might not pass the river that encircles the kingdom of death, but must wander in desolation, with no abiding place, no rest ever for their weariness. To bury the dead was a most sacred duty, not only to bury one's own, but any stranger one might come upon. But this duty, Creon's proclamation said, was changed in the cause of Polynices to a crime. He who buried him would be put to death. Antigone and Ismene heard with horror what Creon had decided. To Ismene, shocking as it was, overwhelming her with anguish for the pitiful dead body and the lonely, homeless soul, it seemed, nevertheless, that nothing could be done except to acquiesce. She and Antigone were utterly alone. All Thebes was exulting that the man who had brought war upon them should be thus terribly punished.
"We are women," she told her sister. "We must obey. We have no strength to defy the state."
"Choose your own part," Antigone said. "I go to bury the brother I love."
"You are not strong enough," Ismene cried.
Why then, when my strength fails, Antigone answered, I will give up. She left her sister. Ismene dared not follow her. Some hours later, Creon in the palace was startled by a shout.
Against your orders, Polynices has been buried!
He hurried out to be confronted with the guards he had set on the dead body and with Antigone.
This girl buried him, they cried. We saw her. A thick dust storm gave her her chance. When it cleared, the body had been buried and the girl was making an offering to the dead.
You knew my edict? Creon asked.
Yes, Antigone replied.
And you transgressed the law?
Your law, but not the law of justice who dwells with the gods, Antigone said. The unwritten laws of heaven are not of today nor yesterday, but from all time.
Ismene, weeping, came from the palace to stand with her sister.
I helped do it, she said, but Antigone would not have that. She had no share in it, she told Creon, and she bade her sister say no more. Your choice was to live, she said, mine to die. As she was led away to death, she spoke to the bystanders. Behold me, what I suffer, because I have upheld that which is high.
Ismene disappears. There is no story, no poem about her. The house of Oedipus, the last of the royal family of Thebes, was known no more. The Seven Against Thebes. Two great writers told this story. It is the subject of one of Aeschylus' plays and one of Euripides'. I have chosen Euripides' version, which, as so often with him, reflects remarkably our own point of view. Aeschylus tells the tale splendidly, but in his hands it is a stirring, martial poem. Euripides' play, The Suppliants, shows his modern mind better than any of his other plays. Polynices had been given burial at the price of his sister's life. His soul was free to be ferried across the river and find a home among the dead. But five of the chieftains who had marched with him to Thebes lay unburied, and, according to Creon's decree, would be left so forever. Adrastus, the only one alive of the seven who had started the war, came to Theseus, king of Athens, to beseech him to induce the Thebans to allow the bodies to be buried. With him were the mothers and the sons of the dead men. All we seek, he told Theseus, is burial for our dead. We come to you for help, because Athens of all cities is compassionate.
I will not be your ally, Theseus answered. You led your people against Thebes. The war was of your doing, not hers.
But Aethra, Theseus's mother, to whom those other sorrowing mothers had first turned, was bold to interrupt the two kings. My son, she said, may I speak for your honor and for Athens?
Yes, speak, he answered, and listened intently while she told him what was in her mind.
You are bound to defend all who are wronged, she said, these men of violence who refuse the dead their right of burial. You are bound to compel them to obey the law. It is sacred through all Greece. What holds our states together and all states everywhere except this, that each one honors the great laws of right?
Mother, Theseus cried, these are true words. Yet of myself I cannot decide the matter, for I have made this land a free state with an equal vote for all. If the citizens consent, then I will go to Thebes.
The poor women waited, Aethra with them, while he went to summon the assembly which would decide the misery or happiness of their dead children. They prayed, O city of Athena, help us, so that the laws of justice shall not be defiled, and through all lands the helpless and oppressed shall be delivered. When Theseus returned,
he brought good news. The assembly had voted to tell the Thebans that Athens wished to be a good neighbor, but that she could not stand by and see a great wrong done. "Yield to our request," they would ask Thebes. "We want only what is right. But if you will not, then you choose war, for we must fight to defend those who are defenseless."
Before he finished speaking, a herald entered. He asked,
"Who is the master here, the lord of Athens? I bring a message to him from the master of Thebes."
"You seek one who does not exist," Theseus answered. "There is no master here. Athens is free. Her people rule."
"That is well for Thebes," the herald cried. "Our city is not governed by a mob which twists this way and that, but by one man. How can the ignorant crowd wisely direct a nation's course?"
"We in Athens," Theseus said, "write our own laws, and then are ruled by them. We hold there is no worse enemy to a state than he who keeps the law in his own hands. This great advantage, then, is ours, that our land rejoices in all her sons who are strong and powerful by reason of their wisdom and just dealing. But to a tyrant, such are hateful. He kills them, fearing they will shake his power. Go back to Thebes and tell her we know how much better peace is for men than war. Fools rush on war to make a weaker country their slave. We would not harm your state. We seek the dead only, to return to earth the body of which no man is the owner, but only for a brief moment, the guest. Dust must return to dust again."
Creon would not listen to Theseus's plea, and the Athenians marched against Thebes. They conquered. The panic-stricken people in the town thought only that they would be killed or enslaved and their city ruined. But although the way lay clear to the victorious Athenian army, Theseus held them back.
"We came not to destroy the town," he said, "but only to reclaim the dead."
"And our king," said the messenger who brought the news to the anxiously waiting people of Athens, "Theseus himself, made ready for the grave those 5 poor bodies, washed them and covered them and set them on a bier."
Some measure of comfort came to the sorrowful mothers as their sons were laid upon the funeral pyre with all reverence and honor. Adrastus spoke the last words for each.
"Capaneus lies here, a mighty man of wealth, yet humble as a poor man always, and a true friend to all. He knew no guile. Upon his lips were kind words only. Eteocles is next, poor in everything save honor. There he was rich indeed. When men would give him gold, he would not take it. He would not be a slave to wealth. Beside him, Hippomedon lies. He was a man who suffered hardship gladly, a hunter and a soldier. From boyhood, he disdained an easy life. Atalanta's son is next, Parthenopeus, of many a man, of many a woman loved, and one who never did a wrong to any man. His joy was in his country's good, his grief when it went ill with her. The last is Tydeus, a silent man. He could best reason with his sword and shield. His soul was lofty. Deeds, not words, revealed how high it soared."
As the pyre was kindled, on a rocky height above it, a woman appeared. It was Evadne, the wife of Capaneus. She cried,
"I have found the light of your pyre, your tomb. I will end there the grief and the anguish of life. O sweet death, to die with the dear dead I love."
She leaped down to the blazing pyre and went with her husband to the world below.
Peace came to the mothers with the knowledge that at last their children's spirits were at rest. Not so to the young sons of the dead men. They vowed, as they watched the pyre burn, that when they were grown, they would take vengeance upon Thebes. Our fathers sleep in the tomb, but the wrong done to them can never sleep, they said. 10 years later, they marched to Thebes. They were victorious. The conquered Thebans fled, and their city was leveled to the ground. Tiresias, the prophet, perished during the flight. All that was left of the old Thebes was Harmonia's necklace, which was taken to Delphi and for hundreds of years shown to the pilgrims there. The sons of the seven champions, although they succeeded where their fathers failed, were always called the Epigoni, the afterborn, as if they had come into the world too late, after all great deeds had been done. But when Thebes fell, the Greek ships had not yet sailed to the Trojan land, and the son of Tydeus, Diomedes, was to be famed as one of the most glorious of the warriors who fought before the walls of Troy. Chapter 19. The Royal House of Athens. I have taken the Procne and Philomela story from Ovid. He tells it better than anyone else, but even so, he is sometimes inconceivably bad. He describes in 15 long lines, which I omit, exactly how Philomela's tongue was cut out, and what it looked like as it lay palpitating on the earth where Tereus had flung it. The Greek poets were not given to such details, but the Latin had no manner of objection to them. I have followed Ovid, too, for the most part, in the stories of Procris and Orithia, taking a few details from Apollodorus. The tale of Creusa and Ion is the subject of a play of Euripides, one of the many plays in which he tried to show the Athenians what the gods of the myths really were, when judged by the ordinary human standards of mercy, honor, self-control. Greek mythology was full of stories such as that of the Rape of Europa, in which never a suggestion was allowed that the deity in question had acted somewhat less than divinely. In his version of the story of Creusa, Euripides said to his audience, "Look at your Apollo, the sun-bright lord of the lyre, the pure god of truth. This is what he did. He brutally forced a helpless young girl, and then he abandoned her." The end of Greek mythology was at hand when such plays drew full houses in Athens. This family was especially marked, even among the other remarkable mythological families, by the very peculiar happenings which visited its members. There is nothing stranger told in any story than some of the events in their lives. Cecrops. The first king of Attica was named Cecrops. He had no human ancestor, and he was himself only half human. Cecrops, lord and hero, born of a dragon, dragon-shaped below. He was the person usually held to be responsible for Athena's becoming the protector of Athens. Poseidon, too, wanted the city, and to show how great a benefactor he could be, he struck open the rock of the Acropolis with his trident, so that salt water leaped forth from the cleft and subsided into a deep well. But Athena did still better. She made an olive tree grow there, the most prized of all the trees of Greece. The gray-gleaming olive Athena showed to men, the glory of shining Athens, her crown from on high. In return for this good gift, Cecrops, who had been made arbiter, decided that Athens was hers. Poseidon was greatly angered and punished the people by sending a disastrous flood. In one story of this contest between the two deities, woman suffrage plays a part. In those early days, we are told, women voted as well as men. All the women voted for the goddess, and all the men for the god. There was one more woman than there were men, so Athena won. But the men, along with Poseidon, were greatly chagrined at this female triumph, and while Poseidon proceeded to flood the land, the men decided to take the vote away from the women. Nevertheless, Athena kept Athens. Most writers say that these events happened before the deluge, and that the Cecrops, who belonged to the famous Athenian family, was not the ancient half-dragon, half-human creature, but an ordinary man, important only because of his relatives. He was the son of a distinguished king, a nephew of two well-known mythological heroines, and the brother of three. Above all, he was the great-grandfather of Athens' hero, Theseus. His father, King Erechtheus of Athens, was usually said to be the king in whose reign Demeter came to Eleusis and agriculture began. He had two sisters, Procne and Philomela, noted for their misfortunes. Their story was tragic in the extreme. Procne and Philomela. Procne, the elder of the two, was married to Tereus of Thrace, a son of Ares, who proved to have inherited all his father's detestable qualities. The two had a son, Itys, and when he was 5 years old, Procne, who had all this while been living in Thrace, separated from her family, begged Tereus to let her invite her sister Philomela to visit her. He agreed, and said he would go to Athens himself and escort her. But as soon as he set eyes on the girl, he fell in love with her. She was beautiful as a nymph or a naiad. He easily persuaded her father to allow her to go back with him, and she herself was happy beyond words at the prospect. All went well on the voyage, but when they disembarked and started overland for the palace, Tereus told Philomela that he had received news of Procne's death, and he forced her into a pretended marriage. Within a very short time, however, she learned the truth, and she was ill-advised enough to threaten him. She would surely find means to let the world know what he had done, she told him, and he would be an outcast among men. She aroused both his fury and his fear. He seized her and cut out her tongue. Then he left her in a strongly guarded place and went to Procne with a story that Philomela had died on the journey. Philomela's case looked hopeless. She was shut up. She could not speak. In those days, there was no writing. It seemed that Tereus was safe. However, although people then could not write, they could tell a story without speaking, because they were marvelous craftsmen, such as have never been known since. A smith could make a shield which showed on its surface a lion hunt, two lions devouring a bull, while herdsmen urged their dogs on to attack them. Or he could depict a harvest scene, a field with reapers and sheaf binders, and a vineyard teeming with clusters of grapes, which youths and maidens gathered into baskets while one of them played on a shepherd's pipe to cheer their labors. The women were equally remarkable in their kind of work. They could weave into the lovely stuffs they made forms so lifelike, anyone could see what tale they illustrated. Philomela, accordingly, turned to her loom. She had a greater motive to make clear the story she wove than any artist ever had. With infinite pains and surpassing skill, she produced a wondrous tapestry on which the whole account of her wrongs was unfolded. She gave it to the old woman who attended her, and signified that it was for the queen. Proud of bearing so beautiful a gift, the aged creature carried it to Procne, who was still wearing deep mourning for her sister, and whose spirit was as mournful as her garments. She unrolled the web. There she saw Philomela, her very face and form, and Tereus, equally unmistakable. With horror, she read what had happened, all as plain to her as if in print. Her deep sense of outrage helped her to self-control. Here was no room for tears, or for words, either. She bent her whole mind to delivering her sister and devising a fit punishment for her husband. First, she made her way to Philomela, doubtless through the old woman messenger. And when she had told her, who could not speak in return, that she knew all, she took her back to the palace. There, while Philomela wept, Procne thought. "Let us weep hereafter," she told her sister. "I am prepared for any deed that will make Tereus pay for what he has done to you." At this moment, her little son, Itys, ran into the room, and suddenly, as she looked at him, it seemed to her that she hated him.
"How like your father you are," she said slowly.
And with the words, her plan was clear to her. She killed the child with one stroke of the dagger. She cut the little dead body up, put the limbs in a kettle over the fire, and served them to Tereus that night for supper. She watched him as he ate. Then she told him what he had feasted on. In his first sickening horror, he could not move, and the two sisters were able to flee. Near Daulis, however, he overtook them, and was about to kill them when suddenly the gods turned them into birds, Procne into a nightingale, and Philomela into a swallow, which, because her tongue was cut out, only twitters and can never sing. Procne, the bird with wings of brown, musical nightingale, mourns forever. "O Itys, child, lost to me, lost." Of all the birds, her song is sweetest because it is saddest. She never forgets the son she killed. The wretched Tereus, too, was changed into a bird, an ugly bird with a huge beak, said sometimes to be a hawk. The Roman writers who told the story somehow got the sisters confused and said that the tongueless Philomela was the nightingale, which was obviously absurd, but so she is always called in English poetry. Procris and Cephalus. The niece of these unfortunate women was Procris, and she was almost as unfortunate as they. She was married very happily to Cephalus, a grandson of the king of the winds, Aeolus. But they had been married only a few weeks when Cephalus was carried off by no less a personage than Aurora herself, the goddess of the dawn. He was a lover of the chase and used to rise early to track the deer. So it happened that many a time, as the day broke, Dawn saw the young hunter, and finally she fell in love with him. But Cephalus loved Procris. Not even the radiant goddess could make him faithless. Procris alone was in his heart. Enraged at this obstinate devotion, which none of her wiles could weaken, Aurora at last dismissed him and told him to go back to his wife, but to make sure that she had been as true to him during his absence as he to her. This malicious suggestion drove Cephalus mad with jealousy. He had been so long away, and Procris was so beautiful. He decided that he could never rest satisfied unless he proved to himself beyond all doubt that she loved him alone and would not yield to any other lover. Accordingly, he disguised himself. Some say that Aurora helped him, but at all events, the disguise was so good that when he went back to his home, no one recognized him. It was comforting to see that the whole household was longing for his return, but his purpose held firm. When he was admitted to Procris's presence, however, her manifest grief, her sad face, and subdued manner came near to making him give up the test he had planned. He did not do so, however. He could not forget Aurora's mocking words. He began at once to try to get Procris to fall in love with him, a stranger, as she supposed him to be. He made passionate love to her, always reminding her, too, that her husband had forsaken her. Nevertheless, for a long time he could not move her. To all his pleas, she made the same answer.
I belong to him. Wherever he is, I keep my love for him.
But one day, when he was pouring out petitions, persuasions, promises, she hesitated. She did not give in. She only did not firmly oppose him. But that was enough for Cephalus. He cried out,
Oh, false and shameless woman, I am your husband. By my own witness, you are a traitor.
Procris looked at him. Then she turned, and without a word, left him and the house, too. Her love for him seemed turned into hate. She loathed the whole race of men, and she went to the mountains to live alone. Cephalus, however, had quickly come to his senses and realized the poor part he had played. He searched everywhere for her until he found her. Then he humbly begged her forgiveness. She could not give it to him at once. She had resented too deeply the deception he had practiced upon her. In the end, however, he won her back, and they spent some happy years together. Then, one day, they went hunting, as they often did. Procris had given Cephalus a javelin that never failed to strike what it was aimed at. The husband and wife, reaching the woods, separated in search of game. Cephalus, looking keenly around, saw something move in the thicket ahead and threw the javelin. It found the mark. Procris was there, and she sank to the ground, dead, pierced to the heart. Orithia and Boreas. One of the sisters of Procris was Orithia. Boreas, the north wind, fell in love with her, but her father, Erechtheus, and the people of Athens, too, were opposed to his suit. Because of Procne's and Philomela's sad fate, and the fact that the wicked Tereus came from the north, they had conceived a hatred for all who lived there, and they refused to give the maiden to Boreas. But they were foolish to think they could keep what the great north wind wanted. One day, when Orithia was playing with her sisters on the bank of a river, Boreas swept down in a great gust and carried her away. The two sons she bore him, Zetes and Calais, went on the quest of the Golden Fleece with Jason. Once, Socrates, the great Athenian teacher, who lived hundreds of years, thousands perhaps, after the mythological stories were first told, went on a walk with a young man he was fond of, named Phaedrus. They talked as they wandered idly on, and Phaedrus asked, Is not the place somewhere near here where Boreas is said to have carried off Orithia from the banks of the Ilissus? That is the story, Socrates answered. Do you suppose this is the exact spot? Phaedrus wondered. The little stream is delightfully clear and bright. I can fancy that there might be maidens playing near. I believe, replied Socrates, the spot is about a quarter of a mile lower down, and there is, I think, some sort of altar to Boreas there. Tell me, Socrates, said Phaedrus, do you believe the story? The wise are doubtful, Socrates returned, and I should not be singular if I too doubted. This conversation took place in the last part of the 5th century BC. The old stories had begun by then to lose their hold on men's minds. Creusa and Ion. Creusa was the sister of Procris and Orithia, and she too was an unfortunate woman. One day, when she was hardly more than a child, she was gathering crocuses on a cliff where there was a deep cave. Her veil, which she had used for a basket, was full of the yellow blooms, and she had turned to go home when she was caught up in the arms of a man who had appeared from nowhere, as if the invisible had suddenly become visible. He was divinely beautiful, but in her agony of terror, she never noticed what he was like. She screamed for her mother, but there was no help for her. Her abductor was Apollo himself, he carried her off to the dark cave. God though he was, she hated him, especially when the time came for her child to be born, and he showed her no sign, gave her no aid. She did not dare tell her parents. The fact that the lover was a god and could not be resisted was, as many stories show, not accepted as an excuse. A girl ran every risk of being killed if she confessed. When Creusa's time had come, she went all alone to that same dark cave, and there her son was born. There, too, she left him to die. Later, driven by an agony of longing to know what had happened to him, she went back. The cave was empty, and no bloodstains could be seen anywhere. The child had certainly not been killed by a wild animal. Also, what was very strange, the soft things she had wrapped him in, her veil and a cloak woven by her own hands, were gone. She wondered fearfully if a great eagle or vulture had entered and had carried all away in its cruel talons, the clothing with the baby. It seemed the only possible explanation. After a time, she was married. King Erechtheus, her father, rewarded with her hand a foreigner who had helped him in a war. This man, Zuthus by name, was a Greek, to be sure, but he did not belong to Athens or to Attica, and he was considered a stranger and an alien, and as such was so looked down on that when he and Creusa had no children, the Athenians did not think it a misfortune. Zuthus did, however. He, more than Creusa, passionately desired a son. They went accordingly to Delphi, the Greeks' refuge in time of trouble, to ask the god if they could hope for a child. Creusa, leaving her husband in the town with one of the priests, went on up to the sanctuary by herself. She found in the outer court a beautiful lad in priestly attire, intent on purifying the sacred place with water from a golden vessel, singing as he worked a hymn of praise to the god. He looked at the lovely, stately lady with kindness, and she at him, and they began to talk. He told her that he could see that she was highly born and blessed by good fortune. She answered bitterly, "Good fortune, say rather sorrow, that makes life insupportable." All her misery was in the words, her terror and her pain of long ago, her grief for her child, the burden of the secret she had carried through the years. But at the wonder in the boy's eyes, she collected herself and asked him who he was, so young, and yet seemingly so dedicated to this high service in Greece's Holy of Holies. He told her that his name was Ion, but that he did not know where he had come from. The Pythoness, Apollo's priestess and prophetess, had found him one morning, a little baby, lying on the temple stairway, and had brought him up as tenderly as a mother. Always he had been happy, working joyfully in the temple, proud to serve not men but gods. He ventured then to question her. Why, he asked her gently, was she so sad, her eyes wet with tears? That was not the way pilgrims to Delphi came, but rejoicing to approach the pure shrine of Apollo, the god of truth. Apollo, Creusa said, no, I do not approach him. Then, in answer to Ion's startled, reproachful look, she told him that she had come on a secret errand to Delphi. Her husband was here to ask if he might hope for a son, but her purpose was to find out what had been the fate of a child who was the son of... She faltered and was silent. Then she spoke quickly. Of a friend of mine, a wretched woman whom this Delphic holy god of yours wronged. And when the child was born that he forced her to bear, she abandoned it. It must be dead. Years ago it happened, but she longs to be sure and to know how it died. So I am here
to ask Apollo for her.
Ion was horrified at the accusation she brought against his lord and master. It is not true, he said hotly. It was some man, and she excused her shame by putting it on the god.
No, Creusa said positively, it was Apollo.
Ion was silent. Then he shook his head. Even if it were true, he said, what you would do is folly. You must not approach the god's altar to try to prove him a villain. Creusa felt her purpose grow weak and ebb away while the strange boy spoke.
I will not, she said submissively. I will do as you say.
Feelings she did not understand were stirring within her. As the two stood looking at each other, Xuthus entered, triumph in his face and bearing. He held out his arms to Ion, who stepped back in cold distaste. But Xuthus managed to enfold him, to his great discomfort.
You are my son, he cried. Apollo has declared it.
A sense of bitter antagonism stirred in Creusa's heart.
Your son? She questioned clearly. Who is his mother?
I don't know. Xuthus was confused. I think he is my son. But perhaps the god gave him to me. Either way, he is mine.
To this group, Ion icily remote, Xuthus bewildered but happy, Creusa feeling that she hated men and that she would not put up with having the son of some unknown low woman foisted on her, there entered the aged priestess, Apollo's prophetess. In her hands she carried two things that made Creusa, in all her preoccupation, start and look sharply at them. One was a veil, and the other a maiden's cloak. The holy woman told Xuthus that the priest wished to speak to him, and when he was gone, she held out to Ion what she was carrying. Dear lad, she said, you must take these with you when you go to Athens with your newfound father. They are the clothes you were wrapped in when I found you.
Oh, Ion cried. My mother must have put them around me. They are a clue to my mother. I will seek her everywhere, through Europe and through Asia.
But Creusa had stolen up to him, and before he could draw back, offended a second time, she had thrown her arms around his neck. And, weeping and pressing her face to his, she was calling him, My son! My son! This was too much for Ion.
She must be mad, he cried.
No, no, Creusa said. That veil, that cloak, they are mine. I covered you with them when I left you. See? That friend I told you of. It was no friend, but my own self. Apollo is your father. Oh, do not turn away. I can prove it. Unfold these wrappings. I will tell you all the embroideries on them. I made them with these hands. And look. You will find two little serpents of gold fastened to the cloak. I put them there.
Ion found the jewels and looked from them to her.
My mother, he said wonderingly.
But then, is the god of truth false? He said I was Xuthus's son.
Oh, mother, I am troubled.
Apollo did not say you were Xuthus's own son. He gave you to him as a gift, Creusa cried, but she was trembling too.
A sudden radiance from on high fell on the two and made them look up. Then all their distress was forgotten in awe and wonder. A divine form stood above them, beautiful and majestic beyond compare.
I am Pallas Athena, the vision said. Apollo has sent me to you to tell you that Ion is his son and yours. He had him brought here from the cave where you left him. Take him with you to Athens, Creusa.
He is worthy to rule over my land and city."
She vanished. The mother and son looked at each other, Ion with perfect joy. But Creusa? Did Apollo's late reparation make up to her for all that she had suffered? We can only guess. The story does not say. Part 6. The Less Important Myths. Chapter 20. Midas and Others. The story of Midas is told best by Ovid, from whom I have taken it. Pindar is my authority for Aesculapius, whose life he tells in full. These Danaids are the subject of one of the plays of Aeschylus. Glaucus and Scylla, Pomona and Vertumnus, Erisichthon, all come from Ovid. Midas, whose name has become a synonym for a rich man, had very little profit from his riches. The experience of possessing them lasted for less than a day, and it threatened him with speedy death. He was an example of folly being as fatal as sin, for he meant no harm. He merely did not use any intelligence. His story suggests that he had none to use. He was king of Phrygia, the land of roses, and he had great rose gardens near his palace. Into them once strayed old Silenus, who, intoxicated as always, had wandered off from Bacchus's train where he belonged and lost his way. The fat old drunkard was found asleep in a bower of roses by some of the servants of the palace. They bound him with rosy garlands, set a flowering wreath on his head, woke him up, and bore him in this ridiculous guise to Midas as a great joke. Midas welcomed him and entertained him for 10 days. Then he led him to Bacchus, who, delighted to get him back, told Midas whatever wish he made would come true. Without giving a thought to the inevitable result, Midas wished that whatever he touched would turn into gold. Of course, Bacchus, in granting the favor, foresaw what would happen at the next meal. But Midas saw nothing, until the food he lifted to his lips became a lump of metal. Dismayed, and very hungry and thirsty, he was forced to hurry off to the god and implore him to take his favor back. Bacchus told him to go wash in the source of the river Pactolus, and he would lose the fatal gift. He did so, and that was said to be the reason why gold was found in the sands of the river. Later on, Apollo changed Midas's ears into those of an ass, but again, the punishment was for stupidity, not for any wrongdoing. He was chosen as one of the umpires in a musical contest between Apollo and Pan. The rustic god could play very pleasing tunes on his pipes of reed, but when Apollo struck his silver lyre, there was no sound on earth or in heaven that could equal the melody, except only the choir of the muses. Nevertheless, although the umpire, the mountain god Timolus, gave the palm to Apollo, Midas, no more intelligent musically than in any other way, honestly preferred Pan. Of course, this was double stupidity on his part. Ordinary prudence would have reminded him that it was dangerous to side against Apollo with Pan, infinitely the less powerful. And so he got his ass's ears. Apollo said that he was merely giving to ears so dull and dense the proper shape. Midas hid them under a cap especially made for that purpose, but the servant who cut his hair was obliged to see them. He swore a solemn oath never to tell, but the secrecy so weighed upon the man that he finally went and dug a hole in a field and spoke softly into it, "King Midas has ass's ears." Then he felt relieved and filled the hole up, but in the spring, reeds grew up there, and when stirred by the wind, they whispered those buried words, and revealed to men not only the truth of what had happened to the poor, stupid king, but also that when gods are contestants, the only safe course is to side with the strongest. Aesculapius. There was a maiden in Thessaly named Coronis, of beauty so surpassing that Apollo loved her. But strangely enough, she did not care long for her divine lover. She preferred a mere mortal. She did not reflect that a